Hello, my name is Rashmi and welcome to the final episode of this podcast series, Road to COP27, Making the Just Transition a Reality. As the Road to COP27 comes to an end, join us for a wash up on what happened, what didn't happen, and what is coming next in the conquest to achieve a just energy transition. The just energy transition was big talk this year, with some national policies like the Just Energy Transition Partnership, or JETP, being announced to support nations and its workers to drive the green economy forwards. This episode will reflect on the Just Energy Transition intervention, the behind the scenes of the COP negotiations, and a forward view as to what is next. This year, and to a degree every year, COP receives negative attention regarding the efficacy of the process and how we form part of that process. COP and the just energy transition is not going anywhere, and we anticipate this will be high up on the agenda next year in Dubai too. As we embark on the road to COP28, we hope to further accelerate the ambition both at national and global levels in line with achieving sustainable development and energy security for all, amongst many other things. So as we wrap up for this final episode, and I'm joined by Eduarda Zoghbi, who comes bearing many titles, so please bear with me as I start to introduce Eduarda, who is a bilateral and multilateral development officer at the Rocky Mountain Institute, senior advisor at Student Energy, and the winner of last year's Revolutionaries Award, which was created in memory of the late Steve Sawyer, founder of GWEC. So Eduarda, big welcome, and thank you so much for offering to take part in this podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Rashmi, for the invitation, and as always, for GWEC's support of my work.
Thank you. And it was also really great to meet you in person as well over the 2 weeks in COP. I think you were there for 1 week, am I right?
I was there for almost the entire event. Yes. Always lovely to meet people in person.
Absolutely. And from what I remember of your role at COP was you being on many of the big platforms, speaking on panels, including some of our own. Was there any highlights for you, or anything that was like a highlight for you over the 2 weeks?
Oh, there were many highlights. I think that being there as a youth representative and also trying to represent the interests of student energy and the global youth focused on achieving more ambition in the energy sector is definitely a highlight. But I guess that in terms of the actual event and the negotiations, as someone who has been a part of a few COPs and also followed this process since I was 12. Wow. I think that one of the things that I would highlight is the fact that we finally took loss and damage seriously. Yeah. We all knew this was going to be an adaptation COP, very centered on how to make progress on that end. But I remember like hearing since maybe COP22 or even before that we have to start thinking about loss and damage, but nothing has really been done. So I was really happy to learn that a fund was created and a few countries have already pledged to contribute for this fund. But, you know, again, as a youth representative, we're also always pushing for more ambition and thinking, well, pledges are pledges. Where, you know, is the finance and how can we make these resources effective in the countries that need the most?
Completely agree. But just to backtrack slightly, how many COPs have you actually attended? Which COP number was this for you?
Well, I think so. Technically, the first one I attended, I did not go in. I was protesting outside in Copenhagen in 2009. Back in the day, young people were not allowed in the COP. Not just young people, but I think the process was much, much more closed than it is today. And then I attended COP22 and then COP26 and now COP27. And it seems that I'll also join COP28. Hopefully so.
Yes, well, we would be delighted to have you taking part in some of the GWEC activities and just to see you there. I mean, one of the things we talk about within the scope of just transition or just energy transition is including women and including like strong female leadership in everything we do. So I would be really upset if you were not there on the big stage and sort of, you know, doing what you do best. We look forward to seeing you there. And just to obviously go back again to what you were talking about, so the loss and damage piece, obviously this was a positive outcome. Would you say there were any sort of disappointing outcomes from your perspective? Because from what I've experienced and the feedback from the NGO community is that there's a lot of disappointment around the language associated with renewables. And then again, if you remember at COP itself, there was a fight on the ground to sort of almost keep 1.5 alive. So are there any parts of the negotiations that you found more disappointing?
I will say that overall, for me, one of the biggest disappointments was because this year was focused on adaptation. I think mitigation and the energy sector as a whole remained in the backdrop of the negotiations. So yeah. It's not that we didn't see discussions around renewable energy, but I think that in comparison to previous COPs, definitely was not a priority as we've seen before. It's complicated because I don't want to say that it's very hard to balance out a priority between adaptation and mitigation. We should all try to do it 50-50, but at the same time, the energy sector being responsible for 2/3 of global emissions, we would hope that countries would be more effective in that sense. Not to mention that it's interesting that I recently read on The Economist that there were around, I think, 600 plus lobbyists from the oil and gas industries who attended COP27, which was a larger number than COP26. So I think that that speaks a little bit about to the process, how it came to be, and the fact that definitely in the final text, we didn't see renewable energy as integrated as we would want to.
Yes, and I guess that is, I mean, the large presence of oil and gas lobbyists is a massive reason as to why there's a lot of concern over next year being sort of heavily influenced or greenwashed, so to speak, by the fossil fuel community. So I guess there's obviously going to be highs and lows of each year. But I think overall, I mean, it could have been worse. We have to take what we've got and almost run with it. Now it's done. But just
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just zooming in on the just energy transition intervention. So one of my reflections was that during the course of the year, this was huge. Like, we highly anticipated just energy transition being a large intervention this year. What are your thoughts on the just energy transition intervention at COP and just the intervention in general?
I think that, well, now that we were criticizing the fact that we didn't discuss energy as much as I wish we had, I think that the one positive outcome was the just energy transition partnerships. I know that at this point, only South Africa and Indonesia have announced frameworks, but other countries such as Vietnam, and I've heard rumors about Brazil potentially doing something about this as well, have been trying to gain more investments, and especially these countries being so reliant on coal for their power generation. What I will say, though, is it's definitely very important to have such a framework in place and attention from the international community. But at the same time, my concern is always that when we use the word just, we're not necessarily having a people-centered approach. And I say this because what I usually don't see in these partnerships and these investment plans is a focus on other sources of energy generation, which include, you know, community solar and also clean cooking, which is one of the sectors that is the one that receives the least funds from investors and impacts directly women and children in developing countries. So obviously it's a success, but I'm always trying to bring a perspective of we can do more. And when it comes to investments, I think that it's important for the donors and the developed countries to understand that justice has to be seen as a bottom-up approach, and not necessarily what we all that have a seat at the table consider justice to be. I was very happy, I will say, another highlight of this COP that I've been noticing starting last year, actually 2 years ago, COP26 in Glasgow, that we've had a massive presence of indigenous leaders and more youth groups, and this is great. But just wanting to call out what an organization that I follow a lot their work called She Changes Climate. They always highlight the fact that I think in COP26, 67% of negotiators were men. So for me, it's just that when we talk about justice, it's not just creating one plan here and one plan there for the energy sector, but it's also trying to include different voices and perspectives, especially from developing countries, to define, you know, the metrics and define the targets of such plans.
I completely agree. And just picking up on two of the points you made, I think the first one being on the JETPs or the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, I think these are very much national frameworks. So they're very high level and focused at big sort of high level interventions or macroeconomics, but it doesn't look at the smaller projects or the lower scale implementation needed. And I think it's really great that you highlighted that point, because it often doesn't get enough attention. And so we see massive figures, but very little focus as to how these are actually translated into realistic and practical solutions and implemented in localities that are the most effective. And then the second point you made about the 67%, was it, statistic?
Yeah. According to UN Women.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that sounds correct. 67% of COP delegates being men. And I think this is extremely, you can definitely see this when you're attending COP on panels. There are some panels, I'm not saying all, I definitely think that, you know, COP and other conferences are doing better at having or avoiding manals, as we term it, all male panels. And so I think we're doing better, but you do see what one of my colleagues referred to as pinkwashing, which is almost just having a female moderator or one female on the panel. And I think one thing we need to do better at, and this goes across the board from like across all private sector companies, is that they need to do better at actually enabling internally having women in senior positions in their company. I mean, we're still seeing the same faces, the same people, the same voices, and this does not allow for a diverse, I don't even know what to say. let me think of how to phrase this.
For a diverse discussion.
Yes, this does not allow for a diverse discussion. And so, if we don't change who speaks and include like these communities, like the Indigenous communities or youth groups, the conversation really will become stagnant. So I think those are two really key points you just made there. And that actually brings me nicely on to my next question for you, which is around youth. Obviously, you're part of Student Energy and you've been really involved with them for a number of years. And so one thing we noticed when we were at the IRENA General Assembly last week is that youth is going to be a massive, massive theme at COP and is going to be a massive sort of intervention. And this is extremely positive for Student Energy and other youth initiatives. But how would you convey the efficacy of youth to those who may suggest that this creates more noise around COP? Because there will be some skeptics that say that including the youth is just sort of an activity and it's not useful. How would you say the youth actually bring something that's new to the COP process and that's meaningful?
Oh, absolutely. And I've heard that complaint several times. And it's, like I said, it's taken a decade or so to finally have young people integrated in this process. I think that in terms of, you know, just for everyone who's listening, you know, the youth that attend COP are usually either selected by their countries or by other organizations because of their work and impact in their own countries or internationally. So we don't just randomly appear at COP to make noise. I will say that what's interesting and what I always defend about the youth perspectives at COP is that usually young people are the ones who are working, studying, and volunteering for their own youth-led organizations, doing research and coming up with advocacy points, working the whole year round, like all of us, all of the listeners, to bring these points to COP. So just so you have an idea how organized these processes are, and a lot of organizations have consultation processes that they are in touch with young people from all over the world. And, you know, I've been part of different mechanisms in which I had to contribute, bring a perspective from Brazil or a perspective from Latin America, and trying to define the scope of climate education or just energy transition. And these documents are taken, you know, to higher level decision makers. So I think that we cannot take that for granted. It's very important. And at the same time, I do believe that, you know, one thing that the youth community now discusses a lot is the fact that it's important for young people as soon as they can to try to specialize more in a topic within the climate space. Because I can understand how, you know, I don't want to say like the older people, the older generations, but whoever's more senior, to just see a lot of protests and think think that youth activism is just about, you know, going to the streets, writing a poster, having someone in the news take a picture, and that's not about it. People often forget what goes on behind it, and the fact that the majority of the young people, especially the ones from developing countries, are really trying to be heard. Because I feel like, you know, in the media broadly, we do tend to focus in one or two countries, in one or two natural disasters. But I remember Vanessa Nakate, a youth activist from Uganda, talking about a trip she made to the Sahel, that even her, as someone from Uganda, was impressed by the fact that, you know, women and children had to walk for days to find water. So I think that sometimes having that very direct narrative and, you know, this type of narrative really inspires change. And I think that that's why not just COP26, 27, and now upcoming COP28, youth will be at the center of everything, because the sooner we have young people learning how to negotiate, how the, you know, UNFCCC process works, I think the better we'll have future diplomats and negotiators to try to find more solutions for climate change, given that we don't have that much time left. Especially, this is my last point, especially someone like me that started a while ago attending these meetings, I will say that it had a direct impact on me wanting to follow a career in the climate and energy space. It's when you feel like you're there, you're empowered, and you can be part of the change that you want to see.
I mean, there's so much you just said there that I'm just almost trying to pick up on, and that I'm left like almost reeling from. But a fantastic point that you've made extremely well is the fact that if we don't put the youth in these diplomatic forums, how else they're going to learn the skills required to drive the transition forward? And this is exactly my point. And it's almost upsetting to hear that you've had to fight this argument quite a lot, as to why having the youth there is important. So quite upsetting, but at the same time it's extremely important we give the younger generation the skills to be able to do this. I mean, COP is not going to be something that goes away unless we solve climate change overnight, and so the youth need to be equipped with the skills to be able to go forward and understand what's going on, but also feel included and also lend to their talent as well. I mean, I think the younger generation, or anyone in their youth, in the youth category, sees things differently to maybe how people who are currently in the most senior position see things. It's really good to have like a fresh pair of eyes on some of the problems and that we're facing, and they may have the answers to a lot of the, or solutions to a lot of the problems we're facing. So I'm with you. I completely agree. We need the youth there, and I'm excited to see what Student Energy will be doing at COP, as well as just in general as well. I think we definitely need more youth, and I would have liked to personally have seen more youth initiatives or more youth involvement when I was at school. It was just something that was kind of unheard of in a way, or maybe I just didn't have access to it. But
no, same same for me. I think it's something that is more recent, and I feel like I'm really proud of seeing like the younger, you know, Gen Zs, all of them are a lot more aware of climate change than in my days, where it seriously was not something that young people would be interested in, or even something that we heard of in schools. I'll just, you know, add one more point to, you know, to both student energy and the youth discussions, because I think it's important to highlight some of the work that we did just briefly on COP. So just thinking, you know, going against this argument of youth just being noisy at COP. So for example, student energy went with a few agenda items to COP27. One of them was launching with Orsted a toolkit to help young people learn, you know, what are the skills needed to enter the energy sector, and companies that are seeking to have younger generations want to work for them, what is it that they have to do? So we were responsible for doing a consultation process. And together, another item was that together with the Global Covenant of Mayors, we're also launching a framework that is a partnership that we're doing to try to improve the way that young people show that they have a history for receiving investments. Because what most companies will say when they want to invest in a you know, youth-led enterprise is that there's no track record, there are no metrics. So we're trying to equip young people, especially energy entrepreneurs, on what are the type of things that they have to include to try to show investors that they are doing the right things, that they are creating impact. and try to mobilize more investments around that. And lastly, I think one thing we're very much looking forward to for COP28 is that we're putting together the Student Energy Summit, which happens biannually, and it's the largest youth-led energy summit that exists. We're organizing 3 days of workshops, networking, a gala dinner, and an award ceremony with the support of many partners that believe that youth are central to the energy sector. And we're very excited because it'll be held in Abu Dhabi and under the auspices of COP28. So we're hoping that we're going to help a lot of young people attend COP28 and vice versa.
That sounds amazing. And I'm excited to see how that turns out. I mean, there was an absolutely huge delegation of youth at the IRENA General Assembly, and they were honestly amazing. Like, they conducted themselves so well. They were really just enthusiastic about it. So I'm excited to see what they do next year and what Student Energy does next year. And it's really great to hear there's an appetite from the private sector as well to recognize the skills of young people and recognize the skills going forward. Also really great to hear that all students are involved in that. So thank you for sharing all of those things. I think that'll be useful to, if there's any youth listeners out there, if they're trying to find out how to get involved, then maybe that's one option for them. And just going forward to round off, looking forward at some of your expectations for next year, how do we keep the just transition alive on the policy agenda for next year? Do we just do more of the same? Is there any ideas you have about what we need to do next?
My biggest concern when it comes to justice and when it comes to, you know, oil and gas projects and also renewable energy projects is that these projects are still happening in developing countries without much knowledge of the population or the leaders. You know, as a recent graduate student, I took a class that was wonderful to learn more about extractive industries and the fact that there's so much asymmetry of information. And I will say, unfortunately, this is not a problem just for oil and gas. It's more common for oil and gas and mining, but the renewable energy sector sometimes also, you know, go into developing countries, not understanding the local context, not, you know, convening with local communities also makes a massive mistake. Because we're not talking about just, you know, justice, energy justice in an international just in an international sense, but I think it's very important to think locally. And one thing that I have witnessed working with energy access and with solar in particular is the fact that, you know, developed countries, and I specifically interacted with a private sector company in Europe that wanted to come to a project in Nigeria, but wanted to, you know, use their own workforce, use their own materials. And I think a lot of what young people want to bring to the table is talk about skills building and the responsibility that these companies have when they go to developing nations to not just come, bring their own people, bring their own materials, develop everything, and then make the country dependent on their maintenance, on their financial support. I think there's so much that even, you know, Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, called out the international community of, like, there's been so much, so many years of financial support to developing countries, and yet we haven't seen much progress. And I think this is one of the main reasons, because energy justice is not just bringing investments to developing countries, but is also working together with local leaders, with local communities, with local youth to understand what the needs are and trying to leverage what their potential is and not just their natural resources.
Absolutely. And I think two big things that stick out with the massive amounts of investment available are obviously supply chain and localization. So for example, it's great that the supply chain is available, but if it's not there to stay, or if local workforces can't be enabled to sort of grow and develop, it doesn't really make sense. It can kind of be counterproductive. And so I think you just touched on some really important points. And also, I like the point you made about almost like critical minerals and the mining communities. I mean, this is something that definitely affects renewable energies and their growth. I mean, I know in wind, there are massive amounts of critical minerals needed for various elements of wind turbine production. And so this is something that the renewables industry has a role and a responsibility to keep an eye on and ensure that these communities and these sort of almost subsectors are regulated and are sort of monitored to ensure that they are operating under just conditions. So some really great points you made there, all super, super important. So thank you, Eduarda. It's been a pleasure to have you on this podcast. And it was a pleasure to spend time with you in Sharm el-Sheikh too. So thank you for sharing your thoughts and reflections. And I really look forward to seeing you up on the big stage next year at COP and throughout the year too.
Thank you very much, Rashmi, once again for the invitation. This was a great conversation. I could go for a couple of hours here. I had still so many points to bring, but yes, just want all the listeners to always reflect about energy justice and having a more bottom-up approach. And lastly, involving young people in the process.
If you are interested in topics like this and all things wind, please feel free to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and of course, visit our website at gwec.net. On a very final note, a big thank you to everyone who came along on this journey with the GWEC team and I. We have really touched on the many different facets that come under the just energy transition and will be working on driving this forward in the work we do going ahead. Just a few personal reflections on COP27 and on the just energy transition. The outcome this year and each year will vary. The host nation can be extremely influential, both in a positive and in a negative way. But what we must bear in mind is what we can do to impact this. As the voice of the global wind energy industry, we are responsible for a fraction of the puzzle and are striving to ensure that our efforts to achieve a positive outcome start now. Reflecting on the just energy transition, the intervention this year at COP27 was huge. It was a hot topic and is here to stay. Without ensuring a people-centered transition, we further run the risk of widening the delta between reaching net zero targets and not. Thank you again for coming along on this journey with me throughout the course of the year, and I look forward to seeing what we can achieve on the road to COP28, making the just transition a reality. Thank you.